Grace and peace be with you. Good morning, everyone. My name is Mark, and I am a pastor here at Sycamore Creek. Most often, you'll find me out at the Potterville campus, but I'm thrilled to be with you here this morning in South Lansing as we wrap up this series on science and faith. Now, we kicked off this series 2 weeks ago. Pastor Tom was here, and he talked about cosmology, the origins of the universe. 14 billion years ago, and he talked about the fine-tuning of the universe and all these physics constants that need to be just right for life to happen, and it was fascinating. And last week, Winston Chu was here from MSU Wesley, and he talked about how do we take the Bible and what the Bible tells us about God and integrate that with science and what we know about the world around us. And today, we're going to wrap this up by tackling one of the most controversial areas of science and faith, evolution. Now, for those of you who don't know me, I was a breast cancer researcher for 15 years. And so today I'm going to talk to you about evolution, and I'm excited because this integration of science and faith, talking about these two things, is one of my passions. I get to combine my love of science with my love of God this morning, and I'm excited about bringing you home and finishing up this series. Now, the Bible begins in Genesis 1, verse 1 with this verse. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And I hope that throughout this series, you have not lost sight of that important truth that God is the creator and sustainer of everyone and everything. It's one of the central beliefs of the Christian faith that God is the creator. But it is a far and distant second to the most important belief of Christians, and that is Jesus Christ is who he said he is. That Jesus' life, his teachings, his death and his resurrection are what matter the most. Those are two central important beliefs in the Christian faith, and the belief in Jesus is far more important than anything that we're going to talk about today. And so I hope that throughout this series, as we talked about science and faith, that as we've engaged science and the best science out there, and we've worked to bring those things together, that you haven't gotten tripped up and you haven't lost sight of those two incredibly important truths. Now, whatever you believe about God and whether he's the creator or not, or whether Jesus is who he said he was, when you're outside and you're in nature, there's this like incredible response that we have to nature, isn't there? Like you'll see a sunset going into Lake Michigan, and like deep within your gut, there's something that's moved by that. Or when you watch a child grow and develop, there's just this sense of awe and wonder that we have about God's creation. And it's not even just stuff that we can see. Sometimes it smells, like the smell of flowers right now. I really enjoy lilacs, and I've been smelling those. And there's just something about lilacs where I'm just like, wow, these are such amazing flowers. And we have that when we encounter creation. There's this deep, visceral response within us. And I think that's what the hymnal can tell us about from the hymn, How Great Thou Art. I love the hymn, How Great Thou Art. And it starts out this way in the first verse. It says, O Lord my God, when I in awesome wonder, that's the awe that we have in creation, consider all the worlds thy hands have made. I see the stars, I see the things that are around me, I hear the rolling thunder, all of my senses are engaged, thy power throughout the universe displayed. We have that, don't we? We have this response to creation, to nature. And that hymn continues in the chorus. Says, then sings my soul, my Savior God. Our soul sings in response to creation, to God. How great thou art, how great thou art. Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee. How great thou art, how great thou art. Now, for all of you who know that hymn, it's probably in your head now. And don't worry, we will sing it later on in the worship service. I'll give you an outlet for that. But I love that hymn. It just perfectly captures that response that we have to creation, the singing of our soul that happens in response to creation. And this is nothing new. People have been experiencing this for centuries. You can go back to the Old Testament, to the poetry book of the Bible, the Psalms, and the psalmists looks at this world around us, looks at what God has created and responds. This is from Psalm 8. When I look at the night sky and see the work of your fingers, the moon and stars that you set in place, what are mere mortals that you should think about them? Human beings that you should care for them. Do you hear that sense of awe and wonder and grandeur about creation that the psalmist writes about? That was centuries ago. That was thousands of years ago. People were encountering creation and their soul was singing. And that continues today, and that continues through science. Now, throughout this series, we've been using a book called The Language of Science and Faith. It's by Giberson and Collins, and it's a fantastic resource for integrating science and faith. It's some of the best science and most accessible science, I think, that you'll find in a book, supported by a strong faith in God and who He is. And in that book, it describes this beauty of creation and how the beauty of creation continues to unfold. I want to read you a little segment from this book, The Language of Science and Faith. In the past couple of centuries, another layer of beauty has emerged. Scientists studying God's creation have uncovered the elegant and hidden foundations of our world. We now understand why the sky is blue and why a sunset is red. We know about chlorophyll and how it gathers energy from the sun to empower plant life. We know that stars shine like the sun by using the energy of nuclear fusion, an almost limitless source of power. As an aside, I don't even understand nuclear fusion, but it's amazing. Our planet, Earth, is a fascinating yet fragile sphere suspended like a dust mote in the life-giving rays of the sun. It rotates reliably on its axis, giving us day and night, and revolves around the sun, giving us regular seasons. Now, those of us who appreciate mathematics find a beauty that's buried deep within nature, rivaling that of a sunset. The created order radiates with layers of beauty from the sunset to the orbit of the electron, from the song of the bird to the laughter of the child. We strain to summon analogies to describe the remarkable world that God has created. Perhaps in some way, we might think of creation today like the humble onion with its many layers. Each layer of creation is beautiful in different ways, and so we unpeel the onion. We unpeel it and we encounter so many different kinds of grandeur and beauty. Here's a quote at the end of this passage that I wanted to share with you. The richest appreciation of creation requires that we ponder the wonder encountered on the surface of the world and how that relates to the beauty in the hidden patterns of nature, how the laws of physics illuminate the beauty of the sunset, how our understanding of human nature draws us to the laughter of children, how genetics opens up the mystery of life. I love the way that Giberson and Collins describe science, because what science does is science takes the onion, it takes creation, and it peels back layer by layer of the creation. And each layer is just as beautiful as the surface. Each layer is just as beautiful as the obvious. And this is one of my favorite parts about being a scientist. So for 15 years, I was a scientist, a breast cancer researcher. And what I loved is each day I could go to work and I was peeling back layers of that onion. I was creating knowledge where no knowledge was before. I was asking questions that no one had asked before. And in doing so, I learned more about God the Creator. And each layer was beautiful. So I worked in a breast cancer lab and I looked at breast cells under a microscope. And I actually brought in some of my pictures here. So I've published many papers, and these are some of the covers of some of the articles that I published. So some of my articles, the images I took got on the cover of the journal. And these are images that were taken. The one on the left was taken with a laser scanning confocal microscope, which I'm sure all of you just used yesterday. And then the one on the right is taken with an epifluorescence microscope, and I won't tell you any more about them because you'll get bored and I'll lose you. But they're beautiful. You look at what you can see under a microscope and it's beautiful. They're like artwork. In the same way that looking at a sunset or looking at a mountain or looking at a stream is like artwork. Each layer of God's creation is beautiful. Now, as we've unpeeled layers of that onion, as we've increased our knowledge, a conflict has developed. A conflict has developed between people of faith, people who affirm that God is the creator of everyone and everything, and a very vocal group of atheists. And what they've done is they have hijacked science to create a tension between science and faith. And so what these vocal atheists have done is they've taken what we've learned about science and they've looked at the origins of the universe. They looked at the diversity of life. They looked at the physical properties of the universe and they said there's no room for God there. Let me use science to prove to you that God doesn't exist. Let me beat you over the head with science. And I'll tell you, people of faith have not responded well to that. Not surprisingly. And let me be clear this morning, I do not agree with that viewpoint. It's a misuse, it's an abuse of science. God is the creator of everyone and everything. But then on the flip side, there's also a group of Christians who have been pretty nasty. And there's a group of Christians who have said that if you believe in God, if you affirm that God is the creator, then you need to swipe aside well-established scientific claims and you need to choose either God or science. And let me be clear as well this morning, I disagree with that viewpoint as well. And so where does that leave us? Well, for most of us, it leaves us glad we're done with high school chemistry. Thank God that's done with. And for many of us, we look at this science and faith stuff and we just think, ugh, I hated science in high school class. Like, I'm done with it. You don't want to think about it. But this is such an important issue. This is such an important issue to address. I've given you one reason already. It's important to address because each layer of the onion is beautiful and each layer of that onion teaches us about God. But even more so, as we talk about science and faith, as we talk about bringing those things together, this is an evangelism issue. This is reaching people with the good news of Jesus Christ. Back in September, I quit my science job and became a pastor. And one of the questions I routinely got from my colleagues at MSU is, when you become a pastor, what are you going to teach your congregation about science? They asked me that again and again. The other question I got routinely, what are you going to teach your congregation about evolution? And that's what we're going to talk about today, evolution. Now, evolution is a distinctly biological process. This is not physics or chemistry. It's biology today that we're going to be talking about. And in maybe more than any other area of science and faith, there has been this happening, butting heads around evolution and around that issue. And so today we're going to wade into that. Now, to talk to you about evolution, the best person to talk about evolution is a biologist. If we were going to talk about you want to lower your cholesterol, and what medication should you take? You talk to a doctor, right? Ask them what medication you'd take. If you were turning left in your car and you kept on hearing a clunking noise in the front end, you'd take it to your mechanic and ask your mechanic for help dealing with it. Today, as we talk about biology and evolution and integrating science and faith, we need a biologist to talk about this. And you have one before you. Whew, that's exciting. So, I graduated from Calvin College with a Bachelor of Science in biology. Then I went on to Michigan State and I achieved my PhD in cell and molecular biology. And along the way, I took biology classes, I took biochemistry classes, I took genetics classes. I stand before you as someone who's taken all of the coursework that you can possibly take in science. I'm a biologist, trained in every way you can imagine. And not only that, but I also did the work of a scientist. I peeled back those layers of the onion. And so I stand before you as someone who's done the work of a scientist, not just theoretical sitting in classes, but who's actually worked as a scientist. And if you go to the premier website for scientists, this is what we use to look at all of each other's research and look each other up. It's called PubMed. If you go to pubmed.gov, I'm sure all of you are going to look it up later today because it's a fascinating website. Not really. It gives you all the straight research stuff, not distilled or explained at an average person level. It's just straight research. And if you go to PubMed and you do a search on my name, Opperly, you don't even need to enter my first name because that's such a weird name. There's no other Opperlys in science. You'll see this. My whole list of publications come up, 19 different publications. I don't want you to read them all right now, or again, you'll probably fall asleep and I'll lose you. But the point is, I've done the work of a biologist. I'm qualified today to talk to you about evolution in the same way that if you had questions about your health, you'd talk to a doctor, or questions about your car, you'd talk to a mechanic. If you have questions about integrating science and faith, talk to a biologist. But maybe even more important today for our discussion is that last year when God called me and said, Mark, I want you to become a pastor, I took off the lab coat. And I set aside my science career. And when Jesus said, go, become a pastor, I said, yes, I will follow you, because such is my love of Jesus, that when Jesus says, go, I follow him. And so one of the things that I am incredibly passionate about is integrating my faith, which is so important to me. I would leave my science career and science and bringing those two things together. And as we get ready to discuss evolution this morning, one of my favorite organizations that I want to introduce you to is called BioLogos. I'll let them introduce themselves.
So what is BioLogos? Well, it all began with a scientist and a book. Francis Collins, the physician and geneticist who led the Human Genome Project, wrote the book The Language of God. In it, he describes his own journey from atheism to Christian faith and the harmony between Christianity and science, and especially evolution. Collins began receiving letters from people asking further questions about science and faith, so he formed the BioLogos Foundation in 2007. The idea was to develop a website to house resources for this conversation. It launched in 2009 and now receives thousands of visits each day. The term BioLogos comes from two Greek words, bios, which means life, like in our words biology, the study of life, or biohazard, something not very pleasant for life. And the word logos, which can mean a bunch of different things, like the study of, or reason, or word. Collins had in mind the use of the term from the first chapter of the Gospel of John, where Christ is called the Logos, usually translated into English as Word. The Gospel starts with, "In the beginning was the Word," and a few verses later says, "All things came into being through the Word." So BioLogos references the fact that Christ is the source of all life, therefore life is an expression of the will of God. Today, BioLogos still addresses the questions people asked Collins, and we're the premier organization producing resources on multiple platforms which celebrate the compatibility of evolutionary creation and biblical faith. These resources are not just for scientists, but also pastors, small groups, parents, and anyone else interested in understanding what science and the Bible reveal about the development of life.
So what BioLogos does is it seeks to help us find a third way. In the one camp, we have the atheists, the people who are saying science proves there's no God. On the other hand, we have the Christians who are saying when you accept God, you have to reject science. And what BioLogos says is no, there's a third way. There's a way that we can bring these things together. There's a way that we can affirm that God is the creator of everyone and everything while still accepting the best science that's out there. And that's the course that I want to chart this morning. Now, we're going to talk about evolution, and to be honest with you, I'd love to just give you a huge science lesson on evolution and just explain it and all of the evidence for it and the detail, but this is not a science talk I'm preaching this morning. Now, if you want, I give really good science talks. I'd be happy to lecture you at some point, but that's not the goal this morning. It's not to give a science lecture this morning on evolution. So in evolution, though, I do need to give a science lecture on what a theory is. Because evolution is a theory, and scientists use theory differently than the average person use theory. So we tend to interchange theory and hypothesis as average people. A hypothesis is you know, like you're making a guess on the way things might be, and we tend to think that theory and hypothesis are the same thing. They're guesses, and they're not in the scientific world. So in the scientific world, theory means something completely different. Now, I went online and I looked up a bunch of different resources and I made up a definition of theory for you this morning and what it means in science, and I can do that because I'm a scientist and this is my training. So here is what a scientific theory is. A scientific theory is an explanation of some aspect of the natural world that can, in accordance with the scientific method, be repeatedly, and let me emphasize that word, repeatedly tested using a predefined protocol of observations and experiments. Established scientific theories have withstood rigorous scrutiny. Again, let me emphasize that. They've withstood rigorous scrutiny and are a comprehensive form of scientific knowledge. Something that has been tested and tested and tested and repeated and repeated and repeated rises to the level of theory. And when I talk to you today about evolutionary theory, there's an irony that evolution has been controversial and it's been much criticized, and that's only made it stronger. You see, there's something about scientists is we love criticism. Bring it on. Science makes criticism and takes it and develops truth further. Scientists love criticism. Legitimate criticism only makes science better. And that's what has happened with evolutionary theory. For the past 100, 150 years, there's been criticism of evolution, and it's made the theory stronger. So today I want to give you what the theory is. I'm not going to give you all the evidence for it, but just what the theory is. And there's three parts to evolutionary theory. The first part is the most controversial. So the first part of evolutionary theory is this, that all current species descended from common ancestors. Just as humans alive today are descended from an increasingly smaller group of previous humans, so all mammals are descended from an earlier group, and all vertebrates from an earlier group of vertebrates, and all animals from an earlier group, and so on. Ultimately, all life that has ever existed on Earth is descended from a single-celled life form that lived almost 4 billion years ago. Now take a deep breath. That's a big thing to swallow, isn't it? All life from a single cell almost 4 billion years ago. Now remember, we've affirmed that God is the creator of everyone and everything, and every layer of the onion is beautiful. And as we look at this, do not lose sight of that. Do not lose sight of the fact that the God who can do miraculous things is also the God who is the creator and sustainer of everything, and that all of life, all of these layers, are a miracle. And who are we to say that God could not have created a single cell 4 billion years ago and then directed and guided and sustained this process of evolution for 4 billion years? You know, we like to think that God just reached down and created us. It just happened instantly. Somehow that might make us feel more special. But I think this process over 4 billion years is just as special. It's just as amazing. It's just as incomprehensible to try to get our heads wrapped around. So the first part of evolutionary theory is that God is a God who works slowly, a God who works over time, a God who doesn't just do things on our timetable. How often has that happened in your life where God didn't work on your timetable, but on his timetable? God's a God of patience. God's a God of slow unfolding, and that is exactly what has happened in the process of evolution. So a single cell produced all of the life that we see today. Now the second part of evolutionary theory is this. It is that changes in species occur gradually over time. That's why you need 4 billion years, as a consequence of mutations, small chemical changes in our DNA that are constantly occurring. Now, most mutations don't really do much. Most mutations are irrelevant. Many are harmful. Some are beneficial and enhance the reproductive success of their hosts. Now, right now, each and every one of you has mutations that are occurring. And what does that mean? That means that each and every single one of you actually has cancer. What? Right now, your body is producing cancer cells through mutations. And for the vast majority of us, our immune system is taking care of them and getting rid of them. But that's one of the underlying drivers of cancer, is mutations. So not all mutations are beneficial. Some are irrelevant. Some are harmful. But each one of us, there are mutations that are constantly occurring. Each living thing, there are mutations that are constantly occurring. And that is the underlying source of evolution, is these mutations that occur within our DNA. That's the second part of evolutionary theory. The third part of evolutionary theory is that species change when beneficial mutations allow certain of them to have more offspring than others. You might have a mutation in you, but if you can't pass it on to your offspring, that's not evolution. It just stops with you. It has to be inheritable. So because mutations result in more offspring, it spreads through the population and comes to dominate. That is evolutionary theory, three parts. First part, most controversial. The last two parts, much less controversial, or much easier to get our heads wrapped around. Now, for those of you whose minds are reeling, there's often this, we talk about evolution and we often say, I don't believe in evolution. And that's fine. You can choose whether to believe in it or not to believe in it. But remember, this is a theory. It's been rigorously tested. It's been repeated over and over again. It's the same level of certainty right now within science. It's the fact that the Earth rotates around the sun and not the other way. It's the same level of certainty we have that the Earth is round and not flat. Now, you're welcome to believe that the Earth is flat. You're welcome to believe that the sun revolves around the earth rather than the earth revolving around the sun. But just because you believe it doesn't mean it's true. And scientists have shown again and again and again that evolution is true. You see, the evidence for evolution is overwhelming at this point. We have had an explosion of evidence over the past 20 or 30 years as the field of genetics has expanded and grown. The evidence is ironclad at this point. Now, you'll often sometimes hear from the vocal minority of Christians that evolution is a theory in crisis and that there's big holes in it and that we should worry about the theory of evolution because it's going to come crumbling down. I have to tell you, that could not be further from the truth. If you talk to scientists and you talk to them about evolution, there is an incredibly small number of scientists who disagree with evolution. Over 98% of scientists agree with evolution. So when I went to science conferences, I would go to the meeting of the Endocrine Society, and I'd gather with scientists, researchers from all over the country. There'd be 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 of us gathered together. I couldn't find a single scientist who disagreed with evolution. I graduated from Calvin College, which is a Christian school. I was a biology major there. I went to all my science classes. There was not a single faculty person at Calvin College who disagreed with evolution. Not one. Now, the evidence is described in this book, The Language of Science and Faith. It's overwhelming. The other area it's overwhelming is the scientific consensus. Scientists agree that evolution is real. It's a theory. It's been tested repeatedly again and again and again. Now, for those of you whose minds are reeling from this, I'm going to give you a little moment to digest. I'm going to throw you a rope and give you two caveats of evolutionary theory. So the first caveat of evolutionary theory is this. It is that evolution does not deal with the origin of life. Evolution has to start with a single cell, and then it goes from there to all the diversity of life we see today. It only deals with the development of life. Now, there's a temptation here as Christians. Aha, we got you, scientists. That was God. God created that first cell. It was a miracle. God just put it together somehow. We'll never understand it. And then from there, evolution took over, and that's a God-directed process. The problem is that argument is a God of the gaps argument. And people of faith have been making that argument for centuries. If there's something that we don't understand, well, that's where God was at work. And the problem is, what happens then when scientists close that gap? Where there's experiments going on right now where scientists are trying to figure out how to create a cell from nothing. And I'll tell you, they probably aren't that far off. I wouldn't be surprised if in my lifetime we understand this. What happens to God? What happens to God's place in the universe if God is only in the unexplainable and not in the explainable? A much better viewpoint to have when we think about evolution and we think about our world is that God is present in every layer of that onion, and there's no layer that we can unpeel where God is not present. There is nothing that science can teach us that is not an aspect of God, the Creator. That's the first caveat. The second caveat of evolutionary theory is this, is that evolution does not say anything about whether the processes that drive it have purpose. See, science deals with the natural world. Questions of purpose, now we're getting into philosophy and theology. Why are we here? Why do we exist? What am I made for? Those are God questions. And what we need to do in the midst of those questions is we need to begin to bring together our theology and our science. We need to bring together our understanding of God, what the scriptures tell us about God. This is what Winston talked about last week. We need to know God and to know who he is, and then bring that together with what we know about his creation and what we learn about God's creation. And I'll tell you, this work of bringing together theology and science, it is messy, difficult work. It's not always fun work to be involved in. But you see, we serve a God who is a God of grace, who looked at us in the midst of our messiness. Looked at the midst of us in the messy situations we're all in. And he loved us so much that he sent his son Jesus for us. God says, you want to see my grace? You want to see my love in action? Look at the person of Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ came to earth. He came and was part of this mess that we live in. God did that willingly for us out of love. And so in turn, we need to engage theology and science, not so that we can beat people over the head with our beliefs, but so that we can share God's love and God's truth with them. It's an evangelism issue. I think we need to keep in mind Paul's prayer. Paul prayed this prayer to the Ephesians. This is found in Ephesians 3. Paul says, when I think of all of this, when I think of what God has done in Jesus Christ, when I think of God's love and his grace, I fall to my knees and I pray to the Father, the creator of everything in heaven and on earth. Paul affirms right away God is the creator. But then he continues in this prayer. He says, I pray that from his glorious unlimited resources, he will empower you with inner strength through his Spirit. If we're not going to check out on this science stuff, if we're going to wade into it and engage it and go to the messy place of trying to figure out how to integrate our science and faith, we're going to need God's glorious unlimited resources to do that. We're going to need God's love to move us forward, not so that we can have more of this, but so that we can bring people together. If we don't have God's love and we go and we try to talk to someone, it's just going to be this. Paul continues. He says, then Christ will make his home in your hearts as you trust in him. Do you trust in God even as science teaches us more about our world? Do you trust in God as we peel back layers of the onion? You show your trust in God by clinging to him, by clinging to who God is and that he is creator as we explore more and more layers of the onion. And then your roots will go strong down into God's love and keep you strong. We need to be rooted in God's love. And may you have the power to understand, as all God's people should, how wide, how long, how high, and how deep his love is. May you experience the love of Christ, though it's too great to understand fully, like a lot of this science stuff. It's too great to comprehend. As we look at science, as we look at this world, may you never lose sight of God's love. That is what's going to bring people together. That's going to integrate our science and faith. Not our amazing intellectual arguments, but it's living out God's love. It's having our roots deep in God's love. And then you will be made complete with all the fullness of life and power that comes from God. That is my prayer for each one of us as we've worked throughout this series to integrate science and faith. That is my prayer for our church, that we would be a place where this happens, where people come together, where there's a third way that's charted. And to help me conclude this, I want to go back to BioLogos, and they're going to give you some concluding thoughts. Listen with me to BioLogos.
We've said that the issue of origins is not a core doctrine of the Christian faith, so it should not divide Christians. But we do see it as an important issue for showing the church and the world the harmony between science and biblical faith. The overwhelming majority of evangelical Christians say science has a mostly positive effect on society. And considerably fewer religious people think science and faith are in conflict than do non-religious people. Yet evangelicals also overwhelmingly reject what scientists have discovered about evolution and the Big Bang. Underlying these statistics seems to be the belief that Christians have their own version of science, and that is good and true, while secular science is seen as godless and wrong. Look at the position this puts people in. Many feel forced to choose between accepting the best science of today or accepting evangelical Christian faith. At BioLogos, we want to show that you don't have to choose between these two. There are actually lots of scientists who are Christians, men and women who fully affirm the central doctrines of the faith and are recognized as first-rate scientists. And all scientists today, whether they're Christians or not, are building on the work of committed Christians in the past who ushered in modern science out of an explicitly religious impulse. Science is science, whether performed by Christians or not. Of course, some people interpret the results of scientific work in ways that can challenge faith, but these interpretations are not the science itself. At BioLogos, we see the results of science not as a threat to our faith, but as revealing more about God's created order. We encourage further exploration of the natural world, knowing that whatever results we find, all truth is God's truth. And we can use those results for the glory of God and the advancement of His kingdom. Whether that is developing cures for disease, caring for creation, or simply praising God for the wonders of His good world.
All truth is God's truth. And as we explore the layers of the onion, may we do that in such a way that it brings glory to God. To me, that's what that song, How Great Thou Art, is all about. It's looking at creation. It's encountering God and then responding with the singing of our soul. And that encounter doesn't just include creation. It also includes Jesus Christ, that most central tenet or belief of the Christian faith. You see, that song continues, How Great Thou Art continues. And a later verse says, and when I think that God, his Son not sparing, sent him to die, this is grace in action, I scarce can take it in, that on the cross, my burden gladly bearing, he bled and died to take away my sin. And then comes the chorus, which is going to be our closing prayer. Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee. How great thou art! How great thou art! Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee. How great thou art! How great thou art! Amen.